I'm going to call this meeting of the House Early Childhood and Family Supports Committee to order for Thursday, June 1st, 2017. Members, as you know, this is our last formally scheduled meeting. We may have at least one additional meeting as we talk about the interim work plan and things. We'll be working through some of those issues, but from a standpoint of that, that's on the current schedule. And of course, part of that will depend on the floor sessions and how that other stuff has to fit. And then Zena will provide us some information about the LPRO research services. Go ahead.
Chair Lively, members of the committee, as you know, the Legislative Policy and Research Office, also known as LPRO or LPRO, was created in 2016 and is led by Chris Reinhart. In addition to committee management services, our office also provides centralized professional and nonpartisan research and issue analysis. LPRO staff are available to provide research services to any member. The committee may also choose to make research requests. Here are some examples of LPRO services: a memo on a specific policy question, a review of academic studies related to a policy issue, analysis of the law and legislative evolution of an issue in other states, analysis of data related to a policy or program, or compiling policy options to address a specific issue. Please feel free to reach out to me and other LPRO staff.
So depending on our interim work schedule, I'm sure we'll have several requests of this particular office, and some of them may be research and otherwise, but I think some of us, we've been around long enough, we didn't have this office an opportunity before, so this is kind of a new opportunity for us legislators to have the office. So once we get a chance to talk a little bit more about the work plan, then we can decide what other support, what we might want to request of the office to do that. So, okay, so I'm going to open an informational hearing on employment-related daycare. And Kim, if you'd come up, please. And thank you, Kim, for being here.
I'm just going to get this out of the way, if you don't mind. Good afternoon, Chair Lively, members of the committee. My name is Kim Fredland. I'm the director of the self-sufficiency programs. And so I'm here to talk with you about the employment-related daycare program today, answer some questions that you guys had for us. And I know that we heard yesterday that your time is limited today. And instead of opting to remove slides for you, I opted to leave them in, and I will either just skip over some or just touch on them briefly, because I really wanted to make sure you had the information. We tried to create this presentation based on the questions that you had. And so I think some of the graphics help to answer some of those questions.
Sure. Okay. Thank you.
So I'm just going to go through the overview. You've actually seen this quickly with me before, so I'll skip quickly over the overview. I am going to talk about the reservation list and calculating the ERDC copayment in a little more detail. So as you might remember, self-sufficiency really has three missions: providing a safety net for Oregonians, family stability when they're experiencing crisis, and a connection to careers. In our programs, we serve overall a little more than a million people a year on average. In the employment-related daycare program, we are currently serving about 15,000 children. So last year, we served a little over 10,000. So the employment-related daycare program is a subsidy program to help low-income families pay for childcare. And the families served, we're actually up a little bit from this number of 8,023 and about 15,000 children. Families have to be below 185% of poverty to qualify for the program. And then they have a co-payment or a portion of that child care that they pay out of their pocket.
And who or what sets that income below 185%?
So you all have set that income limit. In House Bill 2015 last session, there was a change to the exit income limit. So when someone is on the program, we raised the exit income limit so people could stay on the program longer. And really what happens is their co-payment finally exceeds what the child care need is, and that's usually how they end the service with us then.
Thank you.
I think that you all, based on the conversations that I know you've been involved in throughout this session, understand the benefits of quality child care, especially for working families. When they know the kids are safe and well cared for, they can focus on their work, which I think is important to all of us. Quality child care really provides that child development activity that's important to brain development. We also know that especially very young children, the better setting that we can have them engaged in, the better they will, their experience over their lifetime will be. So we had some specific questions related to what is the total funding for the program. And so the state general fund of the program for 2015 and 17 is $71 million. The child care development fund that we get transferred to us through the early learning division is a little over $97 million. So there was also a question about what would it take to cover more families on the employment-related daycare program. I think when I had testified before you, I want to say it was in March. It was a few months ago. I had testified that the current data that we had said about 16% of families were covered. We have some updated information, although it's still old, that about 18% of families in Oregon are covered through this program that could potentially qualify for child care. And that data is from 2013. Part of the lag of that is just being able to get the data. We actually get that from the Oregon State University. They're the ones who do that research. So in order to serve approximately 100 additional families, it would be 1.8, almost 1.9 million. And for 500 more families, you're looking at 9.4 million, and so really to go from 18% to a higher percentage, you can do the math. It grows. The number is quite large.
And are those figures biannually or annually?
Those would be biannual numbers.
Figures.
Yes. Okay. And that's really based on the average of what the average cost of child care payment is for families receiving the program. So the next three slides that I'm going to show you, there was a question about the group rates. And so the state is broken up into three geographic areas, and the rates are different based on those geographic areas. And so you can see Area A is really those more metropolitan areas. Portland, Eugene, Corvallis, Bend, also what we would consider to be higher cost areas. Area B is the other metropolitan areas, Salem, Medford, Roseburg, et cetera. And then the balance of the state is Area C. I'm gonna go into a little more detail on the next couple of slides. So the number of children served in those three areas, as you might imagine, in the most populated Portland, Eugene, Corvallis, we have 61% of all of the ERDC children are served in that geographic area, 29% in Area B, and 10% in Area C, which is the balance of the state. So the next slide really talks about how many children, and then what is the actual cost. And so this is for the month of January. And so there was 8,318 children served in Area A, which again, Portland, Eugene, very populated areas, for a cost of $5.6 million. And the payment per child was $680. And Area B, over 1.7 million for an average cost of 454, and then Area C, 1,300 children and a little over $400.
But those costs are what's are based on just the fact what's authorized in those regions, how much we pay per child.
The difference in those is the overall cost is based on the number of children, for sure, but there's also a difference in the rates.
Right.
And
right.
So those rates are set by that market rate study that is done by the University of Oregon. And so those rates are based on what the market says that it costs to provide child care, and then we pay at the 75th percentile. So the next question was really about how is the employment-related daycare copay calculated? And we wanted to show you a picture of a mathematical formula that looks really challenging, because this is really, this copay formula we think is very challenging and definitely need some revision. As we started to try to dive into being able to explain it, it's really one of those situations where it was set back in 2007, and then there's been changes made over time that were just added to the formula as opposed to the whole formula being re-looked at. And so that's one of the plans that we have over the interim between sessions, is to really re-look at how we're calculating that. The simplest way that I could explain how we calculate the formula is that for the lowest income families, they pay the lowest amount of their income towards child care. And we have a minimum copayment of $27. So for families that are under 50% of the federal poverty level, typically most of those families pay $27. They pay the minimum. So once the income starts to go above the 50% of the federal poverty level, it really starts to be that formula that is applied, so that it's a percentage of their income. That percentage gets higher the higher their income goes. And now that we've raised the exit income limit, at the very highest income limits, the family may be paying 30%+ of their income towards that copayment.
Go ahead. Yeah, I didn't understand the second one. What percent of their monthly income for families over 50%?
It varies. And so Representative Kenny Geyer. It's really hard to give you an exact number, because every family situation varies. And so if their income is 51% of FPL, it would only be above. If it's 72% of FPL, it would be a higher percentage. And so that trajectory is hard to actually describe.
Can you say what the maximum amount it would ever be?
We would
not go over 30%.
As we were looking at, I was just talking with one of the policy analysts before I came over, and as we were looking at it, the highest income limit, she said to me, was 34% of their income. Wow. But that also is at the very highest, because we did raise that exit income limit quite substantially last session. So again, typically what we see happen with families is that the child care need, unless there are lots of children in the home, the child care need is less than the actual copayment by the time you get that high. And so then the parent is just paying all of the child care.
So help me understand. So they come in, they're qualified.
Mm-hmm.
So over time, though, their income changes. And I'm trying to understand at which points is there a decision made about raising the copay, or, I mean, I don't know how does that work?
Yes, so Chair Lively, one of the changes that happened due to the federal legislation changes with the CCDF block grant was that we really looked at income now at a certification period of 12 months. Okay, and so right. We set that for 12 months, and then when we relook at that, we set it for another 12 months, which is much different than we were doing before because it was really changing every quarter.
That's what I thought.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. So we did want to give you one example, or two side-by-side examples, I should say. If you have a family of two that are the family is earning $500 a month, and we always look at gross income before taxes, the family would be paying the $27 because, again, that's the minimum. In the other example, a family of two that's earning $1,500 a month, in this example, would pay $184 for their copayment. And so the copayment is always the first part of whatever that child care bill is, and then the child care subsidy is the rest of the child care up to the maximum.
And the amount of subsidy ends up being different in those three regions.
It does, yes. So the challenges that I feel like we really are having with the ERDC program in general right now is that the way this program is structured is it's a budget-capped program. And so what that means for us is that the program is not open all the time for families to apply for, like we would for SNAP or TANF. The program goes through these periods of where it's open for applicants and where it's closed for new applicants. And I know that the terminology is confusing, but that's really that reservation list that I'll talk a little bit more about in a few minutes. The other challenge that we definitely are experiencing is provider availability. And we've seen that really dramatically change since the regulation changes that came with the federal changes that were implemented in November of 2016. I do have a chart that I'm going to show you in just a bit that'll show you what I mean by that. You know, potential state reductions will again be a challenge for the program because, you know, we anytime we have changes, then that causes that program to maybe not be as open as we want it to be. And then program awareness. We believe that program awareness has suffered because of the opening and closing of the program. So I wanted to talk with you about the caseload and what the effect of the caseload, that opening and closing or that reservation list has had on the caseload. And so what you'll see is the areas of the line graph that are red are when the program was closed. And of course, there are some exceptions to that. Even when the program is closed, families that are leaving the TANF program because of employment can still apply and their application would go through, so that it would be open for them, or foster parents. There's a few other minor exceptions as well. So the areas on the line chart that are green is when the program was open. And what I really wanted to point out is that in the 13-15 biennium, we actually came in $5 million overspent in this program. And again, it's trying to manage it through that opening and closing of the program because you don't have a straight line of families that are eligible throughout. You have this up and down, so you're always trying to shoot for the right amount. And we also were seeing things like the cost per case was rising for providers. We had, you know, done some changes there with the quality ratings and that kind of thing. We also saw that the attrition rate or the families that were leaving the program were changing because of the 12-month eligibility, which was absolutely a good thing, but it also made it then hard to predict because prior to that, we could predict about how many families would leave the program every month, so we would kind of know when we should be reopening that the program up for new applicants. An example of that is that prior to the change of the 12-month eligibility, we saw between 300 and 400 families leaving the program a month, and after that, only 100 or less would leave the program. So definitely doing its job there, right? In July of 2015, so we try to look back at history to make our best guess about what's going to happen in the future. And so what I wanted to kind of point out here is in July of 2015, when we reopened the program, we saw the caseload shoot up about 1,500 families in a two-month period of time. And we kind of saw that trend even in 2014 in about March. We saw that trend also, about 1,500 families. And so when we were looking at, we had the program was closed in 2016 and we were opening it in the summer of 2016. We were expecting the similar kind of 1,500 case opening that we did not see at that time. And so that's really the first indication that we had that the program was starting to behave differently than we had seen in the past. So I also wanted to talk a little bit about the kinds of providers that we have, because I'm going to go into a little more detail about what we've seen with the changes in providers. And so in Oregon, most of the providers are the exempt enhanced family providers. And so those are those family home-based providers. Then the licensed home-based is the next grouping. Center-based is really only about 16% overall. And so those home-based family providers, we saw the biggest impact of the change of the regulations, which the regulations, I'm going to come back to that one. The regulations really were a lot more upfront requirements about what they needed to do in order to be providers. And so prior to the change in 2016, they participated in a two-hour online health and safety class. They did a provider listing form, which included a background check. We only did fingerprints on request. And then within 90 days of their approval, they would do a two-hour in-person orientation. So after the change in November of 2016, we still required the two-hour online health and safety standard, but we then also required a 4 to 6 hour CPR and first aid certification, and this was an expense to the providers up front. A recognizing and reporting child abuse and neglect online class. They still provided the same provider listing form. But in January of 2017, we actually started requiring fingerprints for everyone. And so this was, again, a change for what that background check entailed. Also, they still do need to complete that two-hour in-person orientation within 90 days, and then 6 hours of additional training with each two-year approval. And so when we go back to the pie chart that says most of these are home-based providers, what we've really seen is a reduction in those home-based providers because we believe that based on their you know, usually 3 to 6 months engagement as a provider, that they're not in it to be a provider long term. They're helping their friend out. They're doing this for a family member. And so with these increased requirements, we've seen a lot less of these providers being available and signing up to be in the program, because there's just too many regulations up front for them.
And those increased requirements were state requirements, federal requirements, both?
Federal requirements.
That's what I
thought. So as I mentioned, there's definitely a difference that we have seen in what the regulations have done. And so as you see here, the red bars are when the program was closed. And what we typically have seen is when the program is closed, the number of providers goes down, which is not all that surprising. When the program is open, like you'll see in June to July of 2014, and again in September to October of 2015, when the program is open, or the blue bars, the providers typically start increasing the number of providers that serve families. What we saw, the green bar, is that new regulations in November of 2016, and what we've seen every month thereafter is a reduction in the number of providers. And so that lack of providers definitely has a direct impact on the families, because even if they're eligible for the program, if they can't find a provider who will accept the subsidy payment, then they aren't able to take advantage of the program.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
So, Kim, you said that the green bar was represents federal regulations that mm-hmm. came about?
Yes.
Not state?
Yes. Representative Huffman, yes.
So what kind of communication do we have with the feds explaining that their regulations have had a dramatic effect?
Representative Huffman, we have engaged, as a number of states have, with conversations with the federal government about these changes, and the philosophical response that we're getting is that they want to ensure higher quality and less access, that they would prefer fewer families with a higher quality child care engagement, as opposed to more families with less quality.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
I get that. It's kind of like I'm working on a traffic speed thing with ODOT right now, and it's kind of like, we don't want any fatalities on the road, so we're all going to drive 25 on the freeway, because we want absolute, at some point there has to be balance. I know it's not you.
Representative Huffman, I think Oregon especially is challenged by this, because our makeup of providers is different than a lot of other states. We have our rural or our metropolitan areas in Oregon, but really the balance of Oregon is a rural state, and that is definitely that more home-based provider. You know, we would expect to see more of those providers available. Centers, I would say, have a harder time staying in business in a smaller community where they just are not going to have enough kids to keep their doors open. And so I think it is a challenge that we're going to have to figure out how to do as much as we can to welcome new providers in and see what kind of flexibility that we have. So one of the things that we've recently done is provided the payment for the background check, for instance, so that the provider is not having to do that out of pocket up front. We've been working with our community action organizations and our CCRNRs to really do that outreach about finding providers in the rural areas and working on that. So I think there's some things that we can do, but I do think we're going to continue to be challenged by the federal regulations.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, yes. Oops, in a binding.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is around the requirements for the home providers. Is it just the provider that has to submit to the background check, or is it anyone that lives in the home, and is that also impacting our ability to grow the number?
Representative Bynum, it is everyone in the home.
May I ask a follow-up?
Sure.
So if a person has any sort of conviction, is that a deterrent? Is it a deterrent, or is it something that would exclude people from wanting to go through the process?
Representative Bynum, I am not sure that I know exactly what those requirements are off the top of my head. We would have to follow up. I'm not even able to take a guess at where that line is.
Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Lively, and thank you for the information in the first document, page 4. I've been asking for that for almost 2 years now, so thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I appreciate that a lot. Having said that, I have also been asking for a breakdown of A, B, and C in those categories of in-home, family care, daycare, and then the expanded certificate or the larger certificate. So I'd still like to see the difference between which there's significant dollars difference here on this report, but I'd still like to see them by the categories within the A, B, and C. Right? I want to see what we did in 2015 as we skewed that other qualifications, right? So you took the market base and then we skewed it with other qualifications. I want to see what cash flow to that. So I appreciate that. So if we have that as a continued committee question, which I have put in many committees over the last 2 years, and we finally have a small step forward. So thank you. The other thing I would really like to know is how Oregon compares to other states, if you have data on that, on this type of program, the ERDC program. Like, is Oregon 50% of what other average states? Are we 200%? Do you have data, and can you share that with us? So I'd like to make that a committee question also.
Representative Hayden, let me answer the last question, and then let me go back to the first request to make sure that I want to make sure I understand exactly so that we can get that to you, because I don't want it to be an open question for you anymore.
Okay.
How Oregon relates in rates overall is that we are the first state to set our rates at the 75th percentile, meaning that we've set it initially higher than other states. And some states with the incentive payments or the quality payments actually get to that 75th percentile, but our quality and incentive payments actually will take us above that number.
So there's got to be data, and I've tried to Google it and been unsuccessful. I've tried to Google this and been unsuccessful, so we're gaining ground. So I'd love to see, I can go into education, get 147 pages of just data, right? You know, what's class size, how many days that we don't have absentee and salary pay and PERS and blah, blah, blah. It goes on and on and on. But in this, it's very hard to find data. It's very hard to find data. I'd love a comparison across the U.S. to see what other states are doing. So what I'm hearing is Oregon is the highest paid in ERDC in the nation.
Representative Hayden, I believe that is a accurate comment.
So with that information, I would like to continue to maybe address driving some incentives that could be reasonably attained by our rural partners who are significantly lagging behind here. If we're the highest paid in the A category, which it has to be the A category, that we're the highest paid in the nation, maybe we're putting a little too much effort on that side of metropolitan Portland, and we could work on some incentives to drive to even this out. So I've been working for 2 years to get these numbers, and thank you for starting to open that door.
Welcome. If I can figure out how to go where I want to go, I want to go back.
And I have another meeting scheduled in 1 minute. I apologize.
So, Representative Hayden, before you go,
yes.
You might want to look at slide 15. It does start to show you the quality rating providers in those different areas.
Okay.
But just to follow up with your request, so you want to know, based on the groups, you want to
yes.
know how many are center-based, how many are family-based.
Yes.
Okay, yeah,
I
we can provide that.
I
want
to know what we did with the incentives that push us above the 75. I want to know what effect that had on the pool of funding. I'm just looking
yeah.
basically
yeah.
for a bank reconciliation kind of idea on this funding in each one of those categories. That's all I'm looking for.
We will continue to work with you until all of your questions have been answered.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Under
yeah, this is good. And I'll,
okay.
I apologize. I was reading healthcare most of the time. So. But the reports are getting better.
And he was exacerbating. Mm-hmm.
So, some of the federal changes in 2016 really recommended that states offer incentive payments to quality rated providers. And in the state of Oregon, in House Bill 2015, we stated that subsidy recipients who choose SPARC rated child care providers may also qualify for lower co-payments. Mm-hmm. And so I think those two things in conjunction, if families are choosing those higher rated, there's a financial benefit to them as well, which I think is helpful. So we definitely, I believe, have some work to do in the employment-related daycare program. I will admit that, you know, this being my first year in this job, as we have been answering a lot of the questions that have come from you all, we've really noticed some areas where when we scratch our head and say, I wonder why we're doing it that way, and there isn't anyone on our team that was here when those decisions were made, that really tells us there's an opportunity for us to go back and review that. So we know that we're going to be definitely reviewing the co-payment strategy, because the way the mathematical formula works, it really is something that was set in 2007, 10 years ago, and every time there was a change, we just added to that formula as really, instead of going back and looking at the base formula altogether. So we're definitely going to be doing that. We also know that the way that we open and close the program through that reservation list, which is not really a list at all, it really is not working for families. And so we believe that there were some reasons why that was the selected option. So now we're going to go back to the drawing board and figure out what can we do differently, because that opening and closing, I think, really detracts from people's awareness about the program and its availability. We hear through word of mouth that people think the program is closed when right now it's open. And so we're trying to, you know, chase that down with people and say, no, the program is open. Please, you know, we're here to help. But when it's closed, that really is a problem. We can definitely learn a lot from other states. We're already starting to review what some of those other states are doing. And so I think that that'll give us some information as we try to make some of these corrections. And, You know, so we added a couple of ideas that we already have, you know, about actually if we have to close the program due to budget, maybe there is a way to actually have a list that we manage. The reservation list implies there's a list, even though there isn't currently. So, you know, maybe we could create that kind of a function, or maybe there's something completely different. So we look forward to talking with you more about that after we do some research. We also really wanted to comment on outreach. So we, you know, outreach is done really informally every day. It has always happened, you know, in our offices when families are applying for other services. We also have that informal network that happens in the community when, you know, making sure community programs are aware. 211 is definitely a referral source for us. But we know that we haven't seen the number of families applying recently that we would expect, and so we've really started formal outreach. And so some of those formal outreaches that we've mailed flyers, so to speak, to all of the SNAP recipients who have a child care cost associated with their SNAP case, and that's about 48,000 families. We mailed those in the first part of May, so we're interested to see what the May intake numbers look like. We don't have those yet since it's June 1st. We've also been doing, we did media release through our other networks, really disseminated information to do some more formal outreach. We've never had a need to do outreach for this program because we've always had more families than we had money for, to be quite honest. And so we've never budgeted or had a formal outreach plan, which is another thing that we'll be doing in the future, is creating a small budget so that we can, you know, do things like flyers and make sure that we have that outreach that's consistent. And I think that's it.
Thank you very much. And I think we look forward to working with you. You got some of the questions, things we've talked about. There's a couple things. One, we know that there's a lot more families out there that could probably benefit from the program. It's how you reach them. Yeah. But secondly, if we were able to reach them, in some cases, there's not enough money. But it's hard to make an argument for money when we see some of those other trends, what's going on there. So we appreciate the information and both the work you're already doing on it. And as a committee, we look forward to working with you, how we can support that work and make sure we get the families, those that really can get the benefit from this program, get that benefit. So anything else from any other members? Representative Huffman.
Mr. Chair, so Kim, are you getting any kind of a feedback yet from Lori and the Dalles, for example, on the numbers for May after sending out the letters? Are you starting to get some regional feedback, even though you don't have hard numbers yet? Is it working?
So thank you for the question, Representative Huffman. I actually had a sticky note that I was supposed to share information and I forgot, so thank you for that. So March and April, we saw increases in both months. In March, we actually saw 600 additional families come onto the program, and then a little more than 100, even with the families leaving, a little more than 100 gain in April. What we've heard so far in May is we have heard that families are commenting that they got the flyer. We've heard from 211. We've heard from some of our offices that families have gotten the flyer and, you know, that they're planning to apply or they're interested to learn more. So yeah, we are seeing some of that already happen. Thank you for the question.
It appears, though, the diminishing supply of providers is as big a threat as money is at this point.
Chair Lively, I would absolutely say that is true. But what happens for some of our families is that they apply and we go through the process and determine they're eligible for the program, and then they never find a provider. And that's actually a substantial number of families in that application process that are not finding providers. And it's definitely a big need that I think that we have right now.
Great. Mr. Chair?
Yes, go ahead.
So, Kim, are we doing anything to cultivate providers in rural areas? What's being done there?
So, Representative Huffman, that's one of the responsibilities of the CCRNRs, the Yes, that acronym is not coming to me at the moment. It will in a second. Resource and referral organizations. And so the Early Learning Division actually contracts with them to increase the number of providers across the state. And I know that that was a change that happened just in the last year about what their responsibilities were. So I know that they are working on strategies. We just haven't really seen that pick up yet. One of the things that we're actually doing is that we've heard from some of the centers and things that they typically don't pay. They don't accept families who pay after the fact, and how the subsidy program works is that we pay after the care has been provided, and so they're only able to work with a limited number of ERDC families because they don't have enough cash flow to actually meet their payroll. And so we're looking at options to potentially prepay so that we could expand the number of families in the subsidy program that would be accepted into those situations. And so we're trying to see if some of those kinds of things will actually increase the number of providers that are accepting.
And we do know, we've had a conversation here about even how the families get the pay. So the delay in the money is a problem on both sides of this particular equation, whether it's being paying the providers or the families being reimbursed for the cost. And that's something else I know that's on our list to talk about, how we might be able to make changes to help that work more efficiently. But any other questions?
I guess it's an interesting model where they pay up front. I guess I hadn't thought about that, because in a lot of areas of life, you pay at the end, or I don't know. Mm-hmm. Just kind of struck me as odd. But
well, and again, if you go look at who those providers are, in many cases, cash flow would be enormous. It's a big, big problem to be able to do it. Mm-hmm. So, okay, great. Thank you. Thanks a lot for coming in and saying. We look forward to working with you and others as we tackle these issues.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate your time today.
You bet. I'm going to close the informational hearing, unless there's any further business today. It seems like you have an appointment at 2, maybe.
So we're told.
Okay, I just don't. I don't want to be the one that interrupts that appointment.
You didn't want to be the only one to show up here.
That's right. So we'll adjourn. That's right. So we'll adjourn.